Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
Is that war rocket Ajax? To bring back his body?
Everybody, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts. My name is Chris Sims. With me, as always, is Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, how you doing?
I'm good, Chris.
That's good. Do you know what this is, technically, that I didn't realize until just now? This is our Valentine's Day episode.
It is our Valentine's Day episode. And it's appropriate because we have Kelly Thompson on to talk about Rogue and Gambit, the greatest romance in comics history.
I thought you were going to say it's appropriate because you're my Valentine.
That also, but also the guest. It all fits.
It all works. It's like we planned it. We're very good at this. We've been doing it so long. We're already getting weird, but we do have a great show. Like Matt said, Kelly Thompson is here. We're going to be talking to her about Rogue and Gambit, Ghostbusters, all the great stuff she's doing. She is, of course, the current reigning defending War Rocket Ajax Intercontinental Champion. So we will be talking about that high honor as well. But Matt, what do you say we just get right into the show? Let's do this.
Yes, let's do this. Before we talk to Kelly, we have some business to take care of, as we always do, starting with thanking our newest supporters on Patreon.
That's right, Matt. These are the people. Matt, they got their phones out. They opened up Lyft with a Y. Uh-huh. And they said, hey, take me down to 123 Gimmick Street so that I can give Chris and Matt as little as $1 a month through patreon.com/warrocketajax so that they can pay those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills.
There's only one name to read this week, and that name is Stephen Conway.
Stephen Conway, thank you so much.
You could be like Stephen by going to patreon.com/warrocketajax and kicking in as little as $1 a month to help us keep the show going, help keep Every Story Ever specials going every month, get us to where we do comics catch-up, which is something we've been wanting to do for a while. Snack situation specials continue because of Patreon. And with your Patreon donation, you get ad-free episodes of the show. Some listeners get bonus content, bonus audio. Some get line-stepping privileges for the lists we do. And on the list goes. If any of that sounds cool to you, kick on over to Patreon and throw in a little money. All right, Chris, now that we have done that, let's do some checks and recs.
Let's do it.
Chris, before we started recording, you told me you had a check and an update.
I do have an update, Matt.
Which are we getting first?
Let's go ahead and do the update.
Okay.
Because it will be a check in the future, I believe. And that is, now, Matt, you know that I have a problem with first-person shooters, and not in that I have a moral objection to the violence that I'm totally 100% fine with.
They make you feel bad in the tummy.
They make my tummy feel bad. They make me sad. I gotta lay down. And we were talking about this on a recent episode because you were playing Wolfenstein 2, Shadow of the Colossi.
Yep, that's the one.
And I was like, oh, you know what? Gosh, I would love to play that, but those give me tummy frowns. And then I got an email from a listener, a Patreon supporter, Stephen Gollin, a Steve, as he goes by online. You know him, Matt.
Indeed.
And he said, hey, I know why you get sick. I know why it was like, I know why you could play the Super NES Doom for about 5 minutes before you wanted to die forever. And it is because of the field of view, the motion blurring, the head bob. And in modern games, those are things that you can either minimize or turn off. And he said that that's the reason that I can play Overwatch with no problem, because there's a difference in how it's presented. So he said, hey, here's what you do. He gave me some specifications for what I can set the various settings to. And then he's like, this is literally what he told me. I have an extra copy of the first Wolfenstein game and the new version of Doom that I'll send to you, and you can try them out. I'm going to try it. I'm going to partake in a little experiment where me and Matumi sit down and try and play Wolfenstein with some adjusted settings. And if it works, Matt, I will have an entirely new genre of video game to play.
That's exciting.
I am pretty excited about it. If it doesn't work, I have been authorized to just go ahead and find those games a new home. So we will see what happens. But either way, somebody will be coming out a winner. But that is not my check this week. That is just an update on a previous check and a hint at a check to come, because I got the games in the mail today. Thank you so much, Steve. I will be trying them out soon. But Matt, you know what I have been doing?
What is that? Is this your check? We get into check time here?
We're now into check time.
Okay.
And it'll be a quick one. I know that I ceded most of my check time to update time. And we got to keep this thing all above board. It's tax season.
It sure is.
I have been watching some very bad professional wrestling because I'm sure you noticed this as a professional wrestling podcaster. The WWE Network has put up all of the mid-80s to early 90s Coliseum video VHS compilations, and now you can just watch them anywhere at any time.
Yes, it's a lot of Coliseum video content on the WWE Network now.
Oh, it's all very bad. I shouldn't say all, because apparently there's like a Ric Flair Mr. Perfect match in there somewhere. But I've watched, I started at the beginning with the ones they were putting out in like 1983. And first of all, Vince McMahon gets a special thanks in the credits of these videos that Vince McMahon put out, which I can't decide if that's like the worst thing I've ever seen or possibly the most baller move of all time.
When you're keeping it kayfabe, the only credit you can give the creator of the whole thing is special thanks.
It's bananas, but it is charming in its presentation, and there's like a ton of nostalgia attached because these were the tapes that they had at the video store. They had Starrcade 86. Or Starrcade 87, whichever the one the Skywalkers was. I think that's 87. And they had a couple of these Coliseum videotapes. So this, I think, might have been some of the first WWF stuff that I ever saw, which is probably why I didn't go back to it until like 1997. But I'm very excited about working my way through all this stuff. It's an area of wrestling that I am less familiar with. So join me, won't you, in this trip down awful memory lane. Matt, what's your check this week?
My check is also about some nostalgia, revisiting some things from my misspent youth, but less 80s and more late 90s, because I decided to go back and replay Castlevania Symphony of the Night. I got an itch for it, Chris.
Oh, you mean the greatest video game of all time?
Yeah, it is pretty fucking great.
Yes, it is.
Even to this day, like it holds up so exceptionally well to be a 21-year-old game. I mean, I don't really have anything else to say about it. I just decided to go back and replay it, and it's excellent. And here's the thing: it made me wish for more games like it. Like they're all the DS games and Game Boy Advance games, but like unless you have a DS, you can't play those DS games. They're impossible to emulate, right?
I think you can. I think there are emulators that can do the touchscreen, mm-hmm. like just with a mouse. But you can also play those on 3DS.
Yeah. But like, I don't understand why there aren't more of the, like, I guess indie games are sort of picking up the slack for that genre of game, that quote unquote Metroidvania kind of game.
Mm-hmm. We might be talking about one in about 3 minutes or so.
Okay. That Konami isn't really a game company anymore. And therefore there aren't Castlevania games coming out like every year is such a shame.
We might want to do like maybe an hour long bonus content episode where all we do is talk about Symphony of the Night. Because I was just recently, as listeners might know, I've been guesting on the Retronauts episodes, about Metroidvanias, like the complete History of Metroidvanias. And the last installment of it, we finally got to Symphony of the Night, and I just like it was like the spirit got a hold of me. But there are some good Metroidvania style games, but I will say one nice thing is that Koji Igarashi is currently working on what has been described as a spiritual successor to his Castlevania stuff, which is called Bloodstained. I believe it's called Bloodstained Ritual of the Night. And it was a Kickstarter game that I did back, and I'm very excited about it. It's been in development for a while, but they're posting regular updates. The most recent one came during the Super Blue Blood Moon that we got last month.
Sure.
I'm really looking forward to that. I hope against hope that it holds up. But yeah, Symphony of the Night has never been equaled.
You're right. And one thing that I noticed as I was playing it, like there was some valiant efforts made in the mid 90s to like late 2000s to make good 3D Castlevania games. They never really succeeded.
I don't know that I would call them valiant efforts, but there were efforts.
There were efforts. Playing Symphony of the Night, I realized that Dark Souls is actually, well, Dark Souls and Bloodborne particularly are actually what are the natural 3D successors to, like, Symphony of the Night in particular are. Mm-hmm. Like, those games capture the feel of something like Symphony of the Night, and that sort of working through to discover things and having those moments where you do something so cool and you're like, oh shit, I can do that? Where it's just like, I don't know, the 3D Castlevania games just never clicked.
Yeah, well, they never did the environment that well. Like, I think Lords of Shadow is not a bad game. It's just an unbelievably stupid one.
Castlevania is not a game about, like, cutscenes and story.
Yeah.
It's about atmosphere.
I've said this before, but I feel like the game of the 3D era that did the best job of being a Castlevania was Arkham Asylum. Because it had that same, you know, all of the goals were about motion and finding new ways to traverse this landscape that you were going through, and all the different environments and getting around it in new ways. And also you were Batman, which is nice.
Yeah.
But it had that tight environment in the way that I really love from Symphony of the Night, the cohesive environment.
Yeah. I just like, man, that game is still so good, and that's,
oh yeah, it's
all I have to say, really. All right, Chris, let's make some recommendations. What do you have to recommend?
My recommendation is going to be a video game that Matt, you might want to check
out.
And it is called Wonder Boy: The Dragon's Trap. It is available on Switch in the old Switch eShop. I think it's also available on PS4. But honestly, I'm excited about diving into Doom and Wolfenstein, but I just, like, why are we doing anything that's not on Switch these days? It's the best. Oh, I love it so much.
I believe Doom is on the Switch.
Well, not the copy that showed up very benevolently at my house.
Okay.
But, like, the Switch is just great for, like, playing in bed. You know, like, picking up for a minute and taking a break from work and knocking it out. The portability of it is great. But Wonder Boy: The Dragon's Trap is a remake of a 1989 Sega Master System game. It is a fully faithful remake that was reverse engineered from the original code by a fan of the original game. And it runs so smoothly and so well that there is a button. Like, you can press the shoulder button on the Switch to change the graphics instantly between the original, like, 8-bit Sega Master System graphics and the new, really beautiful hand-drawn animated graphics, which I like quite a bit. The only change that they have made is that you can opt to play as a girl character. It is a incredibly well-crafted Metroidvania. You navigate around this world that's very cohesive and very connected. There's distinct environments. at the end of each boss fight, you are cursed to take a different monster form. So every time you hit like a checkpoint in this game, you have to relearn. You have to learn how to play it as a different character. And there's places that you can go where you can select the form that you want that you get like pretty deep into the game. And there's also an item that you can get where you can change at will eventually. But for the first little bit, you're like, well, I'm a dragon now. I'm a lizard man. So I guess I'm just going to walk around being a lizard man until I figure out how to turn into a piranha. It's really well made. The new graphics are really beautiful. It is obviously a labor of love in a really interesting way. And as someone who never really had a Master System, like most people, I think, it's something that completely passed me by. But it is a game that I think is, if it had been more well known, would be spoken of in the same breath as like a Castlevania, as a like a Mario 3 or a DuckTales, you know, like games from that era that are still regarded as high points today. This one doesn't quite have the look, but playing it with the new graphics fixes that beautifully. So Wonder Boy the Dragon's Trap, I think it's $20 on the Switch eShop. Absolutely worth it. If you've got that Metroidvania itch, like I always do, then it's worth checking that one out to scratch it. Matt, what's your rec this week?
My recommendation is another measured recommendation. It's one that, you know, I can't recommend totally wholeheartedly, but that I did enjoy for the most part. I went to my local cheap theater/pizza restaurant and saw Blade Runner 2049 a couple weeks ago. It's not exactly the movie I wanted.
Okay.
I'll say that. But it is incredibly beautifully shot. It nails a particular atmosphere. It digs into some stuff that is unexpected and kind of and pretty thought-provoking. And I definitely think it's worth watching. But again, like being a fan of the, you know, original Blade Runner, while also being more than aware of its flaws, it didn't pick up from where the previous movie left off in kind of the way I expected or wanted. And it didn't have some of the trappings from the original movie that I would have liked for it to have. Which, you know, is probably like a fanish way of talking about this kind of thing. But for the movie that it is impressive. And it does some cool stuff. I think the thing that I can unabashedly recommend is like just how beautifully shot the movie is. And like the color palettes and the visuals of it, which are incredible. And like, there are definitely worse ways to spend, you know, the 2.5 hours or whatever that the movie is. But again, I can't give it a wholehearted recommendation because I can't say that I absolutely loved it, but I did enjoy it. And if you had any curiosity at all about seeing this Blade Runner movie, I do think it's worth watching.
Now, when you say that it wasn't the movie you wanted it to be, is that just 100% because Jared Leto's in it?
Jared Leto is not my favorite part. He is not my favorite part. I can say that very, very much. Any scene that he's in, he definitely does drag down a little bit. All right, Chris, let's move on. Let's talk about some of the comics that came out this week.
Let's do it, Matt.
So, Chris, last week we talked about Justice League Doom Patrol, the first part of Milk Wars.
Mm-hmm.
The second part of Milk Wars came out this week. It was Mother Panic Batman #1, which had some real fun stuff in it. I really did like it.
I liked it a lot too. And this is Jody Hauser and Ty Templeton.
Yeah.
Who I thought, like, when we got to the credits page, I was like, huh, that's a weird choice for this particular crossover. No, it's the perfect choice for what happens in this book. This, I will admit, is the first Mother Panic story I've ever read. That's a book I've been meaning to catch up on forever, and I've got it, like, it's all loaded up on the iPad, so one of these days it's going to happen. And I was able to follow it, but it's a weird one. And, you know, you go through the same milk stuff that you got in the last episode, and it kind of ends with the same... it's a very classic, like, mid-90s crossover way of all of these stories ending with everybody getting... The call from Cave Carson's cybernetic eye, right?
Yes, yes.
It works, I think. It works really well. So Mother Panic's an Azrael, basically, right?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been keeping up with the regular Mother Panic series, so I'm not the best one to explain this. But I do think that this special, this, you know, this issue does give a decent overview of what Mother Panic's deal is. Mm-hmm. And, like, what is going on here? Putting it in the context of Batman and having this character that, and I'm spoiling the issue here, so warning. Putting it in the context of this, like, what seems like a fake Batman. Like, a Batman imposter, much like Milkman Man was a Superman imposter in the previous issue. But then he turns out to be the for real Batman.
Yeah. He's Father Bat.
He's Father Bat. Putting it in the context of that and putting her experiences in the context of Batman creating this, like, army of little kids who are Robins sort of explains Mother Panic's deal really easily and really well for a new reader. And I think there was definitely an assumption that a lot of people who had not been reading the Mother Panic series might pick this up. Mm-hmm. So the way that it is... It is explained without having to, like, totally rehash the origin again. I think it's well done in here.
Yeah. I really think that, again, for someone like me who knows quite a bit about Batman, but does not have that context for Mother Panic, I feel like that was a really good, like, well-handled way to do it. And you know, I think it paid off. Like, it made me not just want to continue with this series, but to catch up on Mother Panic even more than I already did. Less weird than the Justice League story, but then again, so are most things.
It's also interesting to see in here the notion of like the Page character in contrast to Batman, where, like, she's not a victim of circumstance. It's her choices that led to her being, you know, being this vigilante character. I think the contrast that is shown here is really good, and, like, the themes are really well done. In this comic about milk turning superheroes into weird homogenized versions of themselves.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about Twisted Romance number one, which came out this week from Image Comics.
This is the romance comic that is about the Psychopathic Records family group, Twisted.
No.
Correct?
No. No.
Oh. Well, okay. Well, that was the one I read.
Okay. No, this is the new series from Image that... I don't know if this is going to be an anthology series or not. It feels like the main story in this issue is pretty much... told?
Yeah, I think that I believe it is an anthology, because I don't believe there's a Katie Skelly story in the second issue.
But Alex DeCampi is doing the writing on all of it, I think. But it's the main story here is Alex DeCampi and Katie Skelly.
Two friends of the show.
Yep. Great, great people. It's somewhat Katie's vampire stuff. But, like, a real different take on, like, a vampire sort of character. I think at one point in the story, the difference between an incubus and a succubus is brought up. And maybe that's more what they're supposed to be. These kind of, like, immortal demons that, like, suck the life out of people. But either way, like, the high concept is wild. It's about a you know, instead of a matchmaker, the lead character is intended to destroy relationships. And so he's brought in to like end this relationship between a husband, this woman's husband, and his like new lover. And then he discovers that this new lover of the husband's is a succubus that he used to date, and they used to go around sucking the life out of people. It is a very high concept comic, and it reminded me of My Pretty Vampire in some ways, but I loved
it. The thing that got me about it is that I think it's legitimately kind of the perfect, like the perfect synthesis of what we like about Katie Skelly stuff and what we like about Alex DeCampi stuff.
Yeah.
Like it's rare that we come across a comic that is exactly what we want it to be. And I feel like this was absolutely exactly the comic that I wanted these two creators to produce. It plays to both of their strengths in a really good way. I genuinely enjoyed it. And I also really liked the backup stuff as well. The Megan Cube story, who is someone that I really only know from Twitter.
and that's a text piece.
Yeah, that's a text piece about a vampire and a monster hunter and their romance. It was very fun. And then there's another backup story as well that has this really beautiful painted look to it. And that was that Sarah Horrocks?
Yes, it's Sarah Horrocks. And it's almost abstract, both in the art and the storytelling.
Very fun stuff. And I'm absolutely looking forward to the second issue.
Yeah, for sure. And the second issue, Alex has Alejandra Gutierrez doing the art on the main story there. So it's Carla Speed McNeil is on number 3, and then Trungles is on number 4. I'm looking forward to all 4 issues of this miniseries. Keeping up the romance theme, Chris, Batman 40 is a comic about Batman and Wonder Woman fighting off hordes of enemies for like 40 years and having to not make out while they do it.
I like the story. I like the way it was presented. There's a really, really good moment where Wonder Woman Batman's like, yeah, I miss my dog because we've been fighting these demons for a million years. Wonder Woman's like, yeah, I miss my kangaroo.
Yeah.
Which is a great, like a really fun moment. Here's the problem. And I say this as a big fan of Tom King. This story exists already. It's a Superman story. It's like the second Joe Kelly Superman story, where he and Wonder Woman go into, like, literally go into another dimension and fight demons for 10 years, and Superman doesn't cheat on Lois. Or it's like, this story exists.
Don't you think that Tom King knows that? Don't you think he's kind of purposely writing an echo to that story?
I would not be surprised, but it's a weird thing to do because that's not – it's a story that isn't that I don't feel like is well-known enough that it would be one that you would do a callback to without ever like mentioning it, like without ever saying like, hey, this is what we're doing with this. But it's also not like – I honestly don't think this is Tom King ripping off. It's Action Comics number 761. It's literally the second issue of the Joe Kelly run. It's Kelly and Jermaine Garcia doing the art. I think it's a weird case of parallel thought, but I think somebody should have caught this one. And I don't know if maybe somebody did and it was just like, yeah, it doesn't matter. But it sure is weird to read it in that context.
I definitely do think that there might have been the it doesn't matter. Because, I mean, even though there is that Superman story, I feel like this is telling a different story, right? Like, even with the Superman didn't cheat part, like, this is about Batman and Catwoman trying to make a marriage work when it doesn't seem like either of them really knows if it will.
The thing that King does and Joe Kelly doesn't, because he's doing a story about Batman and not Superman, is that there's never, there's never really a question of whether Superman's going to be good, you know, and there's a constant question phrased in the way of Catwoman trying to be good and Batman trying to be good and to live up to what he wants to be, that I think is way more, there's more doubt in this story because it's Batman and because it's, you know, like, we know Superman not going to cheat on his wife. Come on. But, you know, Batman and Catwoman's relationship is not Superman and Lois's relationship. It's just weird. it's weird that it's so close to the same story.
Yeah. But the ending is different. Because, like, the gentleman goes back to fight the Horde after taking his little vacation.
I do love the gentleman. Yeah, I love
the gentleman.
I want to see more of, like, Gentleman needs a miniseries.
He's such a weird, like, Thor character thrown into the whole deal. But
he is a full-on cuckoo bananas piece of the DC universe to introduce in Batman number 40.
Well, he was around before this, because this is like the third part of the story. But
no, but I guess he was introduced in Batman 39 then. Because I went back and we might have both missed it when it came out, but I went back and read it today to make sure. And yeah, like the gentleman, I love.
But like,
he's a gentleman. But he's not.
Yeah, he's basically fucking Heimdall.
He is a dude who fights all the time with fucking chains, and is named the Gentleman.
Anyway, he goes back to work after taking a little time off. Batman and Wonder Woman come back, and it's like, and Batman isn't like, "Hey, I didn't cheat on you. I was good." It's like Catwoman's like, "Hey, were you good? Did you?" Like, you were with Wonder Woman for a long time. And Batman's like, hey, look, I did my best. And Catwoman's answer, and the way the issue ends, is her telling him, we'll do better.
I think that the message is that, like, Batman's, like, you know, Catwoman's like, hey, did you cheat on me with Wonder Woman? Because, you know, she's Wonder Woman, and you were there with her for 39 years, or whatever it is. And I think when he says, like, not good enough, I think Batman's like, yeah, I definitely thought about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they almost do.
I gave it some consideration.
They almost do kiss at one point. But, like, before we get off of this, we got to talk about how great Joel Jones's art is.
Yes.
It's fucking, fucking amazing in here.
Genuinely. Like, that bit that I talked about with Wonder Woman talking about Jumpa, the expression on Bruce's face makes that panel. Like the dialogue is funny. The expression he has when he finds out Wonder Woman has a kangaroo named Jumpa is among the best facial expressions I have seen in comic books ever.
I think Tom King actually pointed this out on his Twitter. When the gentleman goes to visit his lady friend, Angela, and they hug, and she stands on her tiptoes to hug him, it's like a detail that you maybe wouldn't even notice or think about. But an artist has to, like, be like, okay, what is the body positioning here? Mm-hmm. And Joel Jones draws her standing on her tiptoes for that hug. And it's just like, small things like that make art a thousand times better.
Yeah, she is... We sat next to her at Emerald City in 2014, and she was, like, obviously doing a ton of sketches, and just, like, it was amazing to watch her draw. Like, she is a phenomenal talent in every respect.
All right, Chris, that's going to do it for our comics reviews for this week, but not all our talk about the comics from this week, because the writer of Rogan Gambit number 2, Kelly Thompson, we're going to talk to her right now.
Oh, we should. Joining us for the program this week, we are, I would say we're honored to have our guest.
Is that the word?
I think it is in this case, because you are not just a friend of the show, You are not just a creator that people would recognize from books like Hawkeye, books like Jim, the amazing new Rogue and Gambit series from Marvel, Heart in a Box, all kinds of good stuff. You're also the 2018 War Rocket Ajax Intercontinental Championship winner from the Gordy Awards. Kelly Thompson is here. Kelly, welcome back to the show. How are you?
That's the crowd screaming in the background for those of you at home. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for the award. It's totally unexpected. I am by definition a semifinalist, so a big surprise.
You were not a semifinalist in this case. You were the I shouldn't say only choice, because I did want to give the award to the concept of dogs, because I think dogs had a pretty good year.
Still fair. It's always they're pretty consistent in good years.
One of the things that we talked about with the Intercontinental Championship Award is that it wasn't necessarily your big breakout year in comics. I think that happened. I think that probably happened with Jim, right?
Yeah, I mean, I always find that thing a little weird, because it's like, technically you have to give it to the year you started, like, really creating work and being paid for it, and people, you know, sending you a fan letter and, like, all those amazing things, and you get invited to a con, and, like, so that definitely feels like the breakout. But, you know, there's so much media out there that it takes a while for people to really realize who you are and that you're creating work and to find your work and to respond to it. So, you know, I always feel like that's a little funny that you could give a breakout award to someone who's been working and active and building their career for 5 years, but, oh, they finally got, you know, Batman or X-Men or something big, right, that feels like a milestone. So it's always a little weird. It definitely feels like this year changed things for me, or this past year changed things for me. Mm-hmm. A big launch, like something like Rogue and Gambit, and that story, the first stories where I felt like Hawkeye, where I was pitching what I really believed in and was able to get people to come on board rather than trying to fit something I wanted to do within a pre-existing format, you know what I mean?
I feel like, was the Star Wars book also 2017, or was that 2016?
2017, yep.
Yeah, so by any definition, I feel like it was probably a pretty big year.
Yeah, no, it was a big change last year. It really was. It was a lot of stuff happening, you know. Hawkeye was really, I mean, issue 2 came out in January, so it was really a whole year of Hawkeye, and it had just barely started. Phasma started happening and then had a double release in the fall. You know, I was sort of did my first crossover with Jem, and then that sort of closed out as Rogue and Gambit was starting up. I got the Ghostbusters thing, which had one of the biggest responses online I've ever had. So 2017 was definitely felt like a breakout year. It was certainly for me a different year because, you know, the year I was started doing Jem, I was still only doing like one or two books a month. And honestly, as you guys well know, you can't really live on that. Like, not if you're a grown person who doesn't, you know, live in a basement somewhere. So that this was a year where it was like, oh, I'm an adult and I have a life and I can pay my bills and my taxes with this job, you know? So it was a big difference this year.
That's one of the big earmarks, is like, it was a huge deal for me when I could pay my bills from writing. Yeah. Haven't quite gotten there with just writing comics yet, but one day I'll be there.
I mean, like, you're a million miles ahead of where I was as a freelance writer that's not doing comics, because I couldn't pay a single bill with what I was making freelance doing that. So my hat's off to you for figuring that out. I never managed to figure that out.
Like, you have to be willing to make a lot of compromises.
What is life if not compromise?
Now, one of the things that I'm curious about, since you mentioned it, you said that that Ghostbusters got one of the biggest responses you've ever gotten online, and I'm not surprised by that because of Ghostbusters. I'm surprised by that because you're also someone who just launched an X-Men book. And in my experience with writing an X-Men book was that I knew people loved Jubilee, but I didn't know they loved Jubilee.
Right.
Until they were talking to me about my writing on Jubilee. So
right.
was Ghostbusters really like comparable to the reactions you've gotten? I mean, I know the reaction to Gem was also pretty huge, if memory serves.
It was. I think Gem was huge for me because it was my first. I don't think in the context of some of these other things, it was as big. But some of that is also just because my social media and my sort of platform has grown tremendously in the 3 years since that got announced. And you know, part of the conversation when I got Gem was, you know, there were people who knew who I was and were excited about that, but there were also a lot of people who were like, who? Are you kidding me? Like, this big launch is going to this person who's, you know, for them, never written a comic book. I had written Heart in a Box, but it wasn't published yet. So to them, I'd had one small story in a womanthology from 2 years ago, and I'd published two novels that, you know, you'd either read or you had never even heard of, you know? So I think that announcement was sort of very different. I think it's easier to compare the Phasma Ghostbusters and Gambit and Rogue. I think they got the Phasma. I also think it's just about expectation, because the Phasma one I expected to be big because, you know, you've got a huge Star Wars fan base there, and in a lot of ways that has less to do with you and more to do with Star Wars, which was something that also happened with Power Rangers Pink, by the way. Brendan and I were blown away by the size of response we got in that announcement, and we're like, wow, these Power Rangers fans, they are legion, man. So maybe when I say the Ghostbusters thing, it was a really big response online, people really excited for it, but part of that is my perception of the response. I just didn't expect it to be that huge, you know? The movie has its fans, of which I am one, and that's a big number, and those characters are very beloved, but, you know, it didn't, like, it's not like a Star Wars movie where it rocked the world, right? And it's coming sort of after the fact. You've got this book coming after a movie's been out for a year. So, you know, it's just different. Rogue and Gambit was a really big response.
You know, one of the big differences between, say, like Gem, which the comic came, you know, 30 years after the cartoon existed and had lots and lots of episodes, or, you know, Rogue and Gambit, who have been a lot of people's favorite characters for decades, right? And you know, Ghostbusters, these particular Ghostbusters, like,
yeah,
there's one movie that those characters are in, and it's been around for a year. And it feels like, reading that comic, you know, it feels like you are kind of making an effort to put your stamp on those characters, to grow them, to expand, you know, who they are, because there's more building to do of those characters. Because, like I said, there's just the one movie.
Yeah. It's funny to be doing them at the same time, because they're sort of polar opposite goals, right? So with Ghostbusters, people love those characters, but there's not that much there. There's one movie with four characters, you know, and it's just a sketch, right? It's what those amazing actors have brought to an ensemble piece. And so writing Ghostbusters is just sort of riffing off of what they've done and trying to take it to the most logical conclusion, or when it seems more fun, the least logical conclusion, right? Whereas with Gambit and Rogue, you have literal decades of super convoluted continuity. And for me, because I didn't want to tell just another Rogue and Gambit story that maybe gets lost to the sands of time, I really wanted to clarify who they are, what they are to each other, what their purpose is, and set them on a new path, whether that be the path together or the path apart, and to sort of clear that. But you also want to respect that continuity. So there are really two polar opposite approaches to that and directives, but at the end of the day, at the end of those miniseries, you want the same thing, which is those characters to be primed and ready for you to pick up again, or for someone else to pick up again for a new adventure, right?
Did you have a connection to Rogue and Gambit as characters? And I ask because the thing I've told people was that I you know, when I was 10, I thought, like, oh, they meant so much to me. And then when I was 20, I thought they were, and I've told this to people in interviews about the X-Men, I thought they were the dumbest thing in the world. Like, it's so ridiculous. And then writing them brought me back around. They were the most fun thing I think I wrote in the entirety of X-Men 92 was in the miniseries when we did the Rogue and Gambit picnic.
Yeah.
Not the least of which because I got to write Gambit's Dear John letter to Belladonna, which just said it, not you at Gambit, which I was very happy with. But did you have like that kind of journey, or were they always...
I think they were always important to me. I think, so I had, I don't know, did you come to them through the animated series?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So that's same for me, and I was obsessed. And they were really my gateway drug to comics. Would I have sought out comics anyway after seeing the X-Men animated show if Gambit and Rogue weren't in it? Absolutely. Would I have fallen in love with comics and would that have become a thing? Absolutely. Would I have had the level of obsessedness and it taking over my life without Rogue and Gambit? Maybe not. That was peak me as being any kind of shipper or that, you know, that really wasn't a word when I was a 15-year-old, but, you know, all of that stuff that I see, that obsessive fandom that I see on social media now, had that existed online, me at 15 would have been deep in the neck of that. And I never really walked away from them. What happened to me was I always maintained that love for those characters, and they were always really important to me because they were just, I don't know, it was just such formative years that they were there. But I did have a real problem with a lot of stories I read in the intervening years, and that just I didn't think were quality, or I didn't think lined up with what I thought should be happening, or it was just sort of the disappointment thing. And there were also great stories, but I walked away from comics and from Rogue and Gambit a lot of times, but more just because it wasn't sort of lining up with where I desperately wanted it to go. And some of that is fandom, and some of that is also, I think, a writer, right? Like, As a writer, even if you're not there yet, you're like, ugh, this feels wrong to me. Why is this what's happening? Like, these are the things that should be happening. Like, I had that from go, you know? And so seeing the characters be manipulated in ways that I didn't feel was sort of organic or natural really frustrated me. And so I would sometimes walk away. But I sort of always held on to what I thought they should be as opposed to what I was seeing happen to them. Do you know what I mean? Which sounds incredibly arrogant, by the way, but...
I think the one thing that comics writers all have in common is that, you know, in the modern day, 90% of us started as big fans. So we've all had that moment where we read something and go, well, I could do better than that.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't mean it as an arrogant thing. I mean, I think it probably is on some level, but it's more of just a, wait a minute. No. This is what it should be. Yeah, it's like a fan meets writer crossroads, right? Where you become entrenched in not just, well, I don't like that, but I don't like it, and it should be this, you know? So, but that was one of the weird things about approaching the Rogue and Gambit story is that even though there's stuff I would have loved to have fucking thrown out the window, you can't do that because what's one man's trash is another man's treasure. Like, I don't particularly care for certain stories, but someone else, those are their favorites. So I had to be really careful when I went in because I think I sort of went in really cavalierly like a bull in a china shop when I was first thinking of doing this. And I'm like, oh man, I could just get rid of all this stuff. Maybe they'd let me do, you know, I'll just trash all this and, you know, oh, this is bad and this is bad. And then I was like, wait a minute, someone loves that thing. I can't do that. So I got to find a way to be like, all right, all of this exists. It's all real. It's all true. But what's next?
That's, I think that's why you are fundamentally a better writer than I am, because my instinct is to just be like, no, you're wrong to like this.
Well, there's some of that on the inside for me. Like, sometimes when people tell me their favorite thing, I'm like, are you fucking kidding me, man? Like, that shit sucks. Well,
is there, there a story for Rogue and Gambit that you, that's like a touchstone for you, that you go back to and you're like, yes, this is the ideal. Like, this is the one.
With Rogue and Gambit specifically? Yeah.
I mean, with any other comic, I would be curious to hear your answer, but with Rogue and Gambit specifically.
Yeah, so I think it's cliche, but it's because the story is so good. But I just think, I don't think it's that it's particularly a good story. I just think it's the early days of Rogue and Gambit. You're talking X-Men 4, X-Men 8, you know, X-Men 24, The First Date. Like, those early stories, those really work well to me. And it's not because, oh, they're superior or whatever. I mean, a lot of times they're just partial stories. I think the Gambit miniseries from the 90s, Lee Weeks and Howard Mackey, I think that stands out as an actual Gambit story that has a good supporting role for Rogue. That's great. That's great art. That's really nicely done overall. But more, I would say, they're sort of B and C plot lines through those first 25 or so issues of the new X-Men series. I think those stand out mostly just because they weren't over-manipulating the, hey, we can't touch. Gambit and Rogue not being able to touch is this amazing device that you're just lands in your lap and you're like, oh my God, this is fodder for so much angst. We can do so much with this, right? But it's the same old thing that we see going back to moonlighting, right? Which apparently is time immemorial, is moonlighting days, by the way. That's that's the new time immemorial.
It's pre-Die Hard, which is a different world.
Exactly. So, you know, it's the age-old moonlighting problem. Once these characters have amazing chemistry together, the fans are dying for them to get together, and then the second you do it, it falls apart. Now, I don't actually subscribe to that, because I think it can be done well, and that writers drop the ball. That writers, I don't know if they're married and their marriages aren't great or whatever, but they suddenly forget everything that was magical about those characters, and now that they're together, they've fucked it up. It doesn't make sense in moonlighting to me. They're detectives. There's tons of angst. There's tons of drama. There's tons of exciting stakes you can add. It doesn't make sense in superheroes. There's a million plots we can do. People can lose and gain powers. People's lives can be in jeopardy. There's all these other things we can do. It doesn't have to all spin on, oh, well, now they got together, so it's not interesting. No, now it got together and now it's magical. Like, they should be funny together. They should be mean together. They should be all these things that make characters amazing. So I think with Rogue and Gambit, they had that problem. They were terrified to get them together because then they're not interesting anymore. And so they manipulated it, and it worked for a while. And then it stopped working, and it felt like jerking everyone around. And it felt like, well, should these characters even be together? They're all they are is angst. There's no happiness here. Like, why should I read this? I don't remember the question, but that's the answer.
One of the reasons I asked was because the premise of this first arc is that Rogue and Gambit are going on a vacation where they have to pretend to be a couple, even though they are not currently a couple, which is truly magical device.
I love that. And that's a funny thing that I keep hearing people say. I don't read fanfic, but people keep saying that's a fanfic device. And I'm like, really? Because I think that's a moonlighting Superman or Lois and Clark moonlighting silk stockings trick, right? Where the detectives, yes, exactly. Where they have to go undercover for some reason, and they get thrown into these situations where they have to be a couple. Like, all that TV I absorbed when I was 13 or whatever, you know, it's a great device. It's magical. It brings you everything you want, you know? You can play with all the boundaries.
Fan fiction, as I understand it, loves these two characters have to pretend they're in a relationship, and then, oh no, they fall in love. Like, as I understand it, that is a big thing in fandom, despite the fact that it is from everything else.
Well, every fan watched every episode of Silk Stockings, and they just absorbed that storytelling device. Modern fandom
descends directly from the work of Mitzi Capture.
I am so glad you guys got that reference.
We've watched a lot of USA Network original programming around here, Kelly.
I'm I'm so relieved.
The thing that it reminds me of, and I'm sure you've gotten this as well, is it's maybe my all-time favorite Gambit moment on the cartoon when they have to go investigate Genosha, and Gambit goes undercover, and they're not supposed to tell anyone that they're mutants, but Gambit sees a sign that says, "Ask about our mutant discount." And he turns to Storm, and he's like, "What do you say? Maybe we save 10%.
I forgot all about that. That's awful. He would be excellent at undercover. And Gambit's not cheap. Come on.
He's the best worst. But I love that using the framework of Rogue and Gambit having to go undercover at a couple's retreat, because it gives you the device that allows them to talk about their entire romantic history and history together as a couple. And in the latest issue, there's that wonderful bit. And Perry Perez is the artist, correct?
Perry Perez, yeah.
Yeah. There's that wonderful bit where you have, like, I think it's the therapist asks, like, "So what's your history together?" And there's just overlapping word balloons full of panels.
Yeah.
Which is a fantastic device. I love visual tricks like that. You do a lot of that in Hawkeye, too, and I always appreciate it.
Yeah, it's we had to fight a little bit to get that right. It's very hard to describe that for an artist, I think. And there was a lot of, "What are you talking about? I hate this," kind of going on early on. I had to draw a really bad sketch at one point of what I was talking about. Once Perret was like, "Nailed it," and it turned out so great. I love it. It's a trick that Meredith McLaren and I used in Heart in a Box as well, which has some overlapping themes the more I start to think about it, probably why I thought to use that. But to me, it was just a really great way to address the continuity without getting into it, right? Because, you know, and that's, some fans are never going to be satisfied with that, right? Like, they're going to want, "Well, why aren't they talking about this item and that item, and why aren't they resolving this thing specifically that happened 20 years ago?" And I'm like, because I can't do that. Like, we're not here for that. We're here for a new story, but the plot is to acknowledge all this baggage and, like, move forward. And who wants to read a whole page of that? Like, that would be so overwhelming and awful. But, like, let's just show the visuals. And I think the thing that I feel like 50% of the people I see talking about that page totally get it, and they're excited about it. And like 25% of them get it or don't get it, but don't really care because they're enjoying, like, nerding out over, "Oh, I know what this thing is and that thing is and whatever," and, like, figuring it out. But the other 25% are like, "Well, I don't understand how this thing relates." To which I say, "I'm sorry you don't get it, but, like, haven't you ever had a fight with anyone?" Like, someone said to me online or on my Tumblr, they're like, "Well, what does that first image of Rogue from their first date have to do with anything?" And I'm like, because that conversation doesn't start bad. It starts with this, "We're talking about this thing." And then Rogue's like, "Oh, yeah. And remember that time on that first date when then I got clotheslined off your motorcycle and you weren't even worried about me? You were worried about your bike?" And he's like, "Yeah, but remember the time you left me in Antarctica?" And she's like, "Yeah, but you remember the time you kissed Storm and she was naked in a pond?" Like, I don't know why people... Have you never been in a fight with someone? Like, it doesn't even have to be a romantic person. That's just how fights go. Like, you dredge stuff up, and then horrible things get said that hurt the other person, and you're regretful about that because you don't want to hurt the person you love. But, like, life is trauma, man. It's all there. So I sort of a little bit feel bad for someone who doesn't get that page.
There's so much I really love about it. There's that aspect of it. There's the fact that it is a perfect visual representation of two people with this incredibly complicated history just laying it all out at once for someone who did not realize she was asking such a loaded question.
I mean, that's the best part, right? Is smash cut back to the doctor going, "Okay, so that's a lot. That's a really lot. Let's do something different then." I love this idea of, like, her having no idea what she got herself into with these two. Like, oh, you want to know about things about us? Here you go. Like, you're going to love it. I knew the only way to deal with any of this stuff was to literally work it into the plot. And fortunately, Darren was willing to go with me on that, my editor, even though he was sometimes like, He said to me at one point, he goes, who wants to see Rogue and Gambit on a couch in therapy? And I was like, you can't see me, but I'm raising both my hands, like me. I want to see them in therapy. And he was like, okay.
Yeah, no, like, I think you could be like, yeah, literally everyone who cares about right, these characters.
Right, anyone who likes those characters wants to see that, man. Work it out, guys.
A thing that I love about comics as a medium, and about the superhero genre in particular, is that it's got its own visual language. And I love when characters will interact with each other on the terms of the medium, you know, like, yes. Like will the idea of them speaking in panels is yes. something I really, really love.
Yeah. You couldn't do it in any other media. That wouldn't translate in any other way. Right. It's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's perfect for them. Cause I think, you know, for people, I was going to say for an entire generation, but I think at this point it should be people of a certain age. yeah. Like, I think they're kind of the go-to comics couple, right? Like, if your introduction to Marvel Comics was from that X-Men cartoon, which it certainly was for me, like, Scott and Jean were nothing, you know?
No, I agree. I do. I do. I think that's the go-to couple. I mean, maybe my perception on this is skewed, but, you know, they also always felt younger, right? They didn't feel like Reed Richards and Sue Storm or Scott and Jean, who felt like settled, older couple, even though obviously they were very young. They were like, what, mid to late 20s at most, right? But Rogue and Gambit felt sort of like dangerous and dumb and like they were going to make a million mistakes, but they were like super hot. They just worked, man. And I think that was my big disappointment that I'm a little bit trying to rectify in my own small way, is they just worked, except for nobody actually ever let them work. Like, you know, like, I can't say too much about things without giving things away, but like, it's sort of like when people ask me about Kate and Clint together and writing them together and what do I like about it and things. And it's like, that's a completely different dynamic. But what it has in common is magical chemistry. It's just a different kind of chemistry. But they just know each other and they play off each other. And they're characters who both strengthen each other and weaken each other at the same time. And that's always interesting, right?
Absolutely right. I do think a good number of OG Scott Jean shippers are going to be upset by things that were said.
I don't care, because I like Cyclops and Emma together better, but no. It's not a diss on Scott and Jean, and I'm not trying to call them older. I just, those were more serious characters. They're kinder and smarter and less, I mean, Rogue was a villain. Gambit did bad things. And Jean don't have things in their past that are tricky. I mean, Jean's a phoenix. She eats planets. Like, that's the whole thing. But, you know, they were so good. And Rogue and Gambit sort of came in feeling like the punks that were going to mess around a little bit. And so I think there was just a different energy there. And that was very suited to the sort of 90s, for good or ill, right? It's no disrespect to Jean and Scott. I mean, the disrespect to Jean and Scott is I like Scott better than Emma. That's the disrespect. Come at me. Come at me, people. It's all right. I can take it.
We got to get to Twitter questions here in a second. But if you don't mind me pivoting back to Ghostbusters for a second.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, because there's something in issue 2 of the Ghostbusters series that really struck me, and I'll try my best not to give any of it away, but essentially, we see...
People should have read it by now.
It's true. we essentially see all four of the Ghostbusters' worst fears. And there's not necessarily anything in the movie that I would say seeded what those fears were, but they felt really right. And I'm really curious how you landed on those. I mean, I think The Holtzman one is the one that I think easily makes the most sense. Like, that's the one that I could clearly, like, say, like, of course, to.
Right.
The rest of them are a little more, I don't know if abstract is the word, but I think they took a little more calculating in your head, and I would love to know what those calculations were.
Well, so what I tried to do is for each of them, and it's a little bit subtle, and part of that's just execution versus intention a little bit and collaboration, right? But what I tried to do, there's actually sort of two key fears in each scene, right? So for Holtzman, it's this fear of conforming and this sort of boring, staid office life and being like everyone else, right? Yeah. And then there's this secondary fear of, like, losing her hands and not being able to create, which, of course, ties into the other thing as well. And to me, that one's the strongest to what we know about the character. And some of that, I feel, is just, it was easier because I just get Holtzman, and I think she's, despite being really a little bit smaller role compared to sort of Abby and Aaron, I think it's really well fleshed out in the film. Like, she just sort of lives and breathes that character, and you can feel it. So for Patty, it's this fear of being alone, of not being accepted, of not fitting in. And then I added this thing with creepy dolls, which is sort of hinted at in the, you know, with the mannequin scene in the film. So I felt like that was a good fit. And then those don't tie together as nicely as Jillian's do, Holtzman's do, but I still feel like, you know, our fears don't always work that way. So for Aaron, she's got this huge fear of not being, which I think is clear in the movie, of not being respected, of needing to be legitimate and needing to be believed and not being laughed at. So I put that in, and then I was like, what else is a ridiculous thing to be afraid of? That will be funny, as pays off a little bit in issue 3 today. But that is terrifying for someone. And for me, that's something like bees, where I don't understand why you'd be afraid of a bee. Like, unless you're allergic to it, the worst thing that happens is it stings you. What's so scary? I don't get it. But that's not how fear works. Fear is not rational. I actually had the most trouble with Abby, because Abby is not really a fearful character. She's sort of just goes after it, right? She doesn't care about respectability. She doesn't care about being laughed at. She cares about pursuing what she believes in. And that's a hard character to find fear for. So I just tried to sort of double down on these ideas of the things she had finally won being stripped away, like that being a fear. And then the clown thing was really just fun. And I liked the idea. I liked the idea of playing with something where it's sort of an absurd fear. So of course I can talk myself out of this, but then you can't because it's fear and it's ridiculous and it's terrifying. So that's sort of where they came from for each of them. And I tried to draw as much as I could from the film, but I had to get a little bit creative and extrapolate for some of it. So
I think it worked great. I think they all felt right.
Thank you. The bees one I felt like was the weirdest, and then it ended up paying off the best in issue 3 because I was like, yeah, this is great, because now Jillian can laugh at this like Aaron is an idiot and Aaron can be mad, and then she can be like, no, it's nothing to do with bees. It's just reminding me, and then it leads her to her brilliant moment. It was like, fear is irrational. That's not what this is about, you know? So it worked out.
Yeah.
It's always nice when things come together, even when you didn't figure it out beforehand, which happens a lot.
Well, speaking of people just saying things without thinking about them, it's now time for some questions from our listeners on Twitter.
That's right, Matt. And if the people want to get in on the conversations that we have every week here on the show with people like current, reigning, defending War Rocket Ajax Intercontinental Champion Kelly Thompson, how exactly can they go about that?
First, what they need to do is buy a computer, enter a relationship with that computer, but then realize that that computer can't touch you. Maybe get some special gloves made or something, and then sign up for an account on twitter.com. Wait until Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 6:30 Pacific. One of us, Chris at the ISB, or myself at the Matt D. Wilson, will put out the call for questions And you can ask questions just like these that you're about to hear for Kelly Thompson. And Kelly, I've got two questions here that are somewhat related.
Okay.
But I'll ask them one at a time. The first one is, this is from Lance Bravestar 1 on Twitter. They want to know, which Marvel characters would make a great Ghostbusters team?
I mean, I think a lot of them. I mean, you're talking about superheroes. I think because I'm writing them right now, I mean, how funny would Clint and Kate and Rogue and Gambit be? I mean, I just want to see that book. I just want to see that book right now. Like, let's make it.
Well, that leads into this question from @Dan_Spaceman. How successful would Kate, Clint, Rogue, and Gambit be at busting ghosts?
That's funny. I think that they would be initially absolutely disastrous and would eventually manage to save the day. I mean, that's definitely That's definitely Clint and Kate's MO, is the half-assed, not really well thought out, but we pull it out in the end because we're lucky and we're heroes and we have lots of heart kind of thing. And there's a lot of that to Gambit, too. I think Rogue, she's had enough leadership, team leadership time. She would probably be highly aggravated by these guys initially, but they could get it together and she'd be pretty happy in the end.
I think you unwittingly landed on the name portmanteau of Clint and Kate with Clate.
Because
it definitely couldn't be Kant.
It's awful.
Kant, I think it should be Kant. And we should all remember that.
Just to keep it from never happening.
Good point. Here's a question from SuperSeth64, Seth Finkelstein on Twitter. He asks, what led to the development of the pulp-style, detective-style covers for Hawkeye?
Oh, those are so great.
Ooh, aren't they great? Julian Tadino Tedesco, such a brilliant artist. It was really just because we wanted to bring in the sort of PI noir aspects of Kate's book. We felt like it was something that really set her apart from your average superhero book. So Sana is the one, she was probably the first one who said, what do we think about this idea? And then I went trolling through a ton of like dime store novel covers and all those great noir posters and things. And we started really like honing the look for that. And Julian is so good that, you know, he can just, oh yeah, what style do you want? Let me just do that for you. So, I know that not everyone totally got it, like the tie between the two, but I felt like it worked from day one. I loved it.
Fizz versus the World on Twitter, Michael Scally, wants to know, is Dazzler a Jim fan or a Misfits fan?
Oh, man. That's tough. My instinct is to say Jem, but her punk rock look and her like harder edged attitude of late is definitely more Misfits. So like maybe she went over to the dark side for a little while.
It is now time for Character Corner, the part of Twitter questions where fictional characters ask questions for our guests. First up, we have a character that Chris created a couple weeks ago, the Sandman Hater. The_Sandman_H8R on Twitter, who wants to know, how would replacing Dream and Death with Rogue and Gambit improve Sandman?
Improve it? Is that the question?
Hard agree.
I'll defer to Chris on this one then.
Okay. Here's a question from Stone Cold HCC, an account that exists only to ask questions on War Rocket Ajax. Stone Cold asks, what should I get the missus for Valentine's? A Chewbacca mask?
I mean, Rogue and Gambit number 2.
Good answer. Yeah.
If only there was a kissing variant. What is Marvel thinking, I ask you?
Every book should have a kissing variant in February, honestly.
Agreed. Hard agree.
That is going to do it for Character Corner. Here's one from CJ Tour, continuing the Valentine's theme, though. Who would plan a worse Valentine's date, Peter Venkman or Gambit?
I mean, Peter Venkman, for sure. Gambit, where does he get this reputation? Gambit is a super smooth operator. Like, the only reason he wouldn't plan a good Valentine's Day is, I guess, because he doesn't have to work that hard to get the ladies. They just want him. So, like, maybe if you don't have to work that hard. But, like, he's a really good cook. He loves a candlelight dinner. He's got great taste, good moves. Come on.
Vinkman is definitely the kind of guy who's going to, like, try to wing it through the date.
Totally try to wing it. And honestly, he's hilarious, so you'll have a great time. But, I mean, he didn't plan anything. It's just fortunate that he's very charming and funny.
I forgot about Gambit being an extremely good cook. That is good content.
Right? Come on.
Here's a question from Greg Silber, which you may not be able to answer, Kelly, but I will ask it. Greg says, I love your Hawkeye run, and I'm sad it's leaving. Will we see Kate anywhere else soon?
We will. That will is very strong. It's not 100% for sure. Things could go wrong, but I'm developing something very cool with her, and I just saw the proofs for Hawkeye 16, and Alana, our editor, wrote in it, Kate Bishop will return in August 2018. So that feels pretty definitive to me that we're going to get greenlit on this thing we're doing. So I hope she'll be back. Short hiatus. And I think you guys will love what we're cooking up.
And here's a follow-up from Greg. What will become of Lucky, a.k.a. Pizza Dog? He is a good boy and deserves a good comic to call home.
He absolutely does, and that's an important question. It's possible we'll get to keep Lucky. I'm not sure. There will be some fighting in the courts, some rights issues, who should be the parent. I'm not sure what's happening with Clint, with that name on it, and that it'll be Clint starring in it. So possibly he'll have to go back to be with Clint, but maybe he'll get to stay with Kate. Hope springs eternal.
Just spitballing here. Miniseries, battle for the cowl style, custody battle for Lucky the Pizza Dog.
Yeah, but then Kate and Clint have to be on the outs, and I don't ever like to write that.
That's fair. Last question. This is from at Elusive Pale Jerk on Twitter. Kid Presentable, he is known as. He says, in the first Avengers film, Hawkeye uses a hacking arrow to hack into S.H.I.E.L.D.'s computers. Is this a high point or a low point of the Hawkeye legacy? And where does one obtain a hacking arrow?
I don't remember that. Do you guys remember that?
I don't remember that happening, but I'm intrigued.
I'm not doubting that that happened. I haven't seen the first Avengers movie since its release.
Listen, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, and I'm not against, like, cool stuff like that happening. But let me just tell you, my sensibility in comics is more when, like, Matt Fraction writes USB arrow, and it's, you know, a USB on the end of an arrow, and then Kate's complaining that it's only like 128 kilobytes or something, like, and you can't even fit anything on it kind of thing. And Clint's like, you could put a whole CD on there or whatever the line is, like 10 songs or something. That's more my arrow sensibility. Fishnet arrow, USB arrow. These are my things.
I wish that my wife, who back when she liked superheroes, saw the Avengers movie several times in theaters, was awake, because I would absolutely ask her if there was a hacking arrow in it.
Well, I've seen it many times. It's been a while, I agree. I mean, I guess it... Because Hawkeye is under control of Loki for... And that stone thing, or whatever it is, for a lot of the movie. So maybe it's in the very beginning?
Or maybe he uses the Hawkeye arrow, or the hacking arrow, while he's under Loki's control, because he is hacking into S.H.I.E.L.D.
Maybe.
So perhaps that is it. This is a mystery we will attempt to solve at some point.
It would be very easy to solve it, but I think we should let it remain a mystery. Maybe there will be a new character in Character Corner next week.
Maybe you should just wake up your wife. She'll love that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Kelly, this was too fun and went by too fast, but we have to wrap up the interview here, so please tell all our listeners where they can find you online and find your work.
You can find me on Twitter at 79 semifinalist. Everywhere else, it's 1979 semifinalist. And you can buy my books in comic book stores and bookstores and on Amazon and Comixology. And please do that so I don't have to leave the house and can continue wearing pajamas as often as possible.
Our guest has been the War Rocket Ajax Intercontinental Champion, Kelly Thompson. Kelly, it is always an absolute pleasure to talk to you. I can't wait to see what you do next, but I am absolutely loving what's coming out right now.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, guys. I had a great time. I can't believe we didn't talk about me giving Rogue and Gambit a new canon first kiss. What a waste.
Thanks once again to Kelly Thompson for joining us. If you haven't already checked out Rogue and Gambit, it is genuinely great, and you should. Speaking of characters like Rogue and Gambit, Matt, what a segue. It's time for the segment of the show where we rank the best and worst comic book characters there are. That's right, it's time for Panel President.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
From the President's office in the White House.
Yes, indeed. This is Panel President, the segment where you send us lists of comic characters and we rank them on an ever-growing master list. Listener Thomas Foss has given us three lists of characters to choose from.
Tom Foss, who's been around since the comics blogger internet days. Tom Foss has been here a while.
Here's what we got. We can choose from on-panel presidents.
Ooh, interesting.
The characters defined by a single story list.
Ooh.
Or denizens of the fourth world.
I want these characters that are defined by a single story. That sounds very interesting and also makes it very easy for us to talk about them.
All right. First up, we have Arthur Light, Dr. Light.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, God damn it, Matt. I wanted to have a good time.
He's very bad.
Here's the thing. He's not, though. He's not, though, until he
but
was.
That one story.
I thought we were going to get characters who were like in a single story and made an impact, not characters who were completely ruined forever by a single story.
I mean, look, he was mediocre before that.
But he was a perfectly good mediocre villain. He was a perfectly good shitty adult supervillain who got his ass kicked by teenagers. Like that Suicide Squad story where he goes to talk about characters from the fourth world. The one where he goes to Apocalypse is great.
I mean, he's got to go near the bottom of the list, right?
I mean, if you want to talk about characters that I never want to see again, he is number 312.
Hemogoblin, there's nothing good with Hemogoblin, right?
That's the thing. Like, there's enjoyable Dr. Light stories. There's just one that's the fucking pits.
Would you rather read Funky Winkerbean or a comic with Dr. Light in it?
Matt, I think the record will show that I would rather read Funky Winkerbean.
Okay.
Because here's the thing. Because of that story, we can never see Dr. Light again. That dude shows up on Teen Titans Go, and I do not like it.
Yeah.
I don't want to see Kimi Ohoshi again, and I like Kimi Ohoshi.
What about compared to Terry Long, who is objectively the worst?
He sucks real bad. Ugh, God.
Let's just rip off the Band-Aid and put him between Funky Winkerbean and Terry Long.
Okay. No, because he's not as good as Jam. I think he goes between Jam and Marcus.
Okay, Jam and Marcus then.
God.
Because Marcus is similarly bad, but Marcus has never been in anything good.
Yeah.
Okay. Then between Jam and Marcus goes Dr. Light.
310. God. Tom Foss, I was excited about you. This is how you're going to do me?
Next on Tom's list is Doomsday.
Significantly better than Dr. Light.
Significantly better than Dr. Light. Probably in the lower part of the list, because, what is there to Doomsday?
Hey, is Doomsday, the worst idea that has been in, that sticks around forever and is going to stick around forever? Because he doesn't make any sense, is the thing.
He's just the character that killed Superman.
Yeah. He's Zeus, right? Zeus from No Holds Barred, the movie?
Yeah. Zeus had more of a personality than Doomsday.
That's true. Zeus. What if Doomsday was like, Doomsday?
Yeah. Like, what is there to Doomsday other than he's like a pointy monster who punches?
The stuff with him being like the evolutionary experiment, right? That's not how evolution works at all. Like, if you don't know about Doomsday's origin, which if you ever want to see Doomsday's origin, there's an amazing Stuart Immonen bit where he does it in the style of like Winsor McCay. That's phenomenally beautiful. The whole deal was like there was this scientist on, like, I think it was on Krypton, who took this genetic material and would throw it to the monsters. And then it would die, and then he'd clone it and try it again. And, like, bro, that is not how that works. You're, like, that's not – you're not selecting traits. That's not what that is. You can't just throw the same shit out there over and over.
If he's an evolutionary experiment, shouldn't he be smarter instead of, like, totally mindless?
I mean, you would think. That's an excellent question, Matt. Here's the thing, though. I really like the death of Superman as a story, but not the part where Superman and a bone monster punch each other to death.
Yeah.
That part's pretty bad, actually. I don't think he goes below like a John Arbuckle.
No, John Arbuckle's way too low.
Because here's the thing about Doomsday. It's still kind of exciting when he shows up.
Yeah.
And you can do really good things with him. Like when Jimmy Olsen became a Doomsday in All-Star Superman. That shit was rad.
So, well, is he worse? That's Jimmy Olsen as Doomsday. That's not the character Doomsday, though. Is he worse than Hush?
No, he's better than Hush.
All right, here's what's right above Hush. Nomad, Vibe, Polka Dot Man, The Key, Maxi Zeus, Man-Bat.
I think he's better than Man-Bat.
All right, Robbie Baldwin, Speed Demon, Skin Maggot Sink.
Okay, I think what we have to do is we got to go up by arch-villains, right? Is he better than Professor Zoom?
No.
Matt, would you be more excited to see Doomsday show up in a comic than Eobard Thawne?
I mean, the Reverse Flash is in some bad stories. But I think there's way more storytelling potential with the Reverse Flash than there is with Doomsday.
Okay. Well, he's got to be better than David Knight.
Okay. Then I think I like Puck more than Doomsday also. So let's put Doomsday between Puck and David Knight.
How great would those Talking with David stories be if Jack Knight went into the dream world and it was fucking Doomsday? Like, you know, and a bone monster was in there with the red bee?
Doomsday. If he talked in that Zeus voice? Here's the deal. I think number three on this list is unfair to say that this is a character defined by one story.
Okay.
Jean Grey.
Then I think we still have to rank her, even though, because we're not ranking the quality of the list, you know?
Yeah, we're ranking her for sure. I'm just saying, like, I think that's an unfair assessment of Jean Grey. I think there's a lot more to Jean Grey than that.
I think you're right, but I also feel like there is certainly a... It is the thing that's always going to hang over her head.
I think Jean Grey is, like, certainly top 100 material on this list.
Really? See, I don't think I like Jean that much. I like Jean just fine, but I mean, like, in the like we talked about with Kelly.
But she's going to go above Rorschach and KG Beast.
Is she going to go over KG Beast?
Well, I definitely would put her above Rorschach.
Okay, I think we put her before. Okay, so we're looking right at the 100 mark, yes?
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Number 100 is Taskmaster. I think Jean's probably better than Taskmaster. Because Taskmaster is a costume and a cool power, you know?
Yeah.
Jean is, for better or worse, more than that. I'd say better than Wildcat.
Misty Knight's where it starts to get a little hazy.
I think Misty Knight is where it starts to get hazy, but I cannot say that she's not better than Caitlin Fairchild, you know? Yeah. Damian Wayne is, I think, that's the sticking point.
All right. Well, let's say that between Damian Wayne and Caitlin Fairchild.
I mean, are we good with that?
I feel like I'm pretty good with that.
All right, then I think that's where we have to put her. So that is where. Number 97 on the list. Jean Grey, a.k.a. Marvel Girl, a.k.a. Phoenix.
The Phoenix.
A.k.a. The Phoenix. A.k.a. Jean Grey.
Up next on Thomas's list is Roy Harper. A.k.a. Speedy, a.k.a. Arsenal, a.k.a. Red Arrow.
I think this one might not be fair because what's the one story? Is it Rise of Arsenal or is it Hard Traveling Heroes?
I mean, it could be either one, and they're both bad.
They're not good for him.
Yeah.
I don't like him.
No, like he's a superhero character who's not ever remembered for doing anything heroic.
You know what I actually went back and reread? Not too terribly long ago.
What's that?
That first arc of Brad Meltzer's Justice League.
Oh, yeah.
Which you might, I don't know if you recall this, but that is where he rebrands himself as Red Arrow. That sucks. It's as bad as I remember. And as listeners will recall, I remember it being pretty fucking bad.
Is he as bad as Lucy Lane?
I have like a visceral hatred for Lucy Lane that I just like is irrational and unfair. But like my feelings on Roy Harper are just like, get this guy the heck out of here.
All right. How does that line up with Cyborg Superman?
Tobias Hank Henshaw?
Yeah.
Time of the DC Universe's Reed Richards?
Yeah.
Well, it's not great, buddy. I think Roy Harper is worse than Cyborg Superman. I'm gonna come down on it.
Is he comparable to Nermal?
Yes. What do you think, Matt? Better or worse?
Well, here's who. Hank Hall is below Nermal.
That guy sucks. That guy sucks real bad.
I think he's below Nermal. I think he is right below Nermal.
Hey, you remember what's like real bad in that Justice League run? How Roy Harper like has a crush on Hot Girl because she's a pretty bird, and that's the thing that Green Arrow always calls Black Canary.
Yeah, that definitely means he goes below Nermal. So let's put him between Nermal and Hank Hall.
All right, so many Hanks in comics. I know one in my life.
A lot of Hanks.
All right, so here we go. Number 301. I guess he's Arsenal now, so that's how I'm going to put him on the list. Arsenal, a.k.a. Roy Harper, a.k.a. Red Arrow.
A.k.a. Speedy,
that's true.
Rounding out Tom's list is Superboy Prime.
I kind of like Superboy Prime.
But Superboy Prime definitely sucks.
No, he definitely sucks. I admire the sheer... It's not even gall. It's like the ballerness of Geoff Johns being like, the arch nemesis of the DC universe is some dude who talks shit online. Because that's us, man. That's literally us. It's literally like if those books were coming out today, he wouldn't be on forums. He'd have a fucking podcast. Actually, he'd probably have a YouTube channel.
He'd have a YouTube channel, yeah.
But man... Oh, man. I kind of like him.
He's defined by one story, and that one story super, super sucks.
Well, the thing is, it sucks to make him a villain when he's so clearly a guy who's supposed to, like, go off to heaven forever. Like, that's what sucks about that story. His little space prison isn't supposed to be a prison. It's supposed to be heaven. Like, it's where Golden Age Superman went. That story has Golden Age Superman getting beat to death.
Yeah, and he caused it.
The fuck is up with that?
And then at the end, he gets captured by Green Lanterns, and he gets taken to space prison, and then he carves a bloody S in his chest.
Oh, it's very bad. Still kind of like sucks. Him.
All right, so where is they suck, but we kind of like him, even though I don't kind of like him?
Again,
is that where Eradicator is?
Like, what movie is it where somebody sees a great white shark and they're like, I admire its purity? Because that's how I feel about Superboy Prime.
You know who Superboy Prime is super comparable to? Robbie Baldwin.
Ooh, you talking about Speedball?
Yeah.
Talking about Penance?
That's who I'm talking about.
I think Speedball is better. Like Superboy Prime has maybe half a good story under his belt and a bunch of stuff that's bad. But then okay, all right, I get it.
I know you hate Man-Bat.
I do fucking hate Kirk Langstrom, aka the Man-Bat.
You don't even admire Man-Bat's purity. So could he go between Speedball and Man-Bat?
Is that a fair place for Superboy Prime in your estimation?
I mean, I think he would probably go lower.
Where do you want to put him? Because I'll admit that like my misplaced affection for him is bad.
I think he plays his role much the same way that Pat Reynolds does.
Ooh, see, that's a choice comparison, Matt. That's the good stuff.
But I hate him more than I hate Pat, and I hate Pat a lot. I would put him between Pat and Will Payton.
Man, we fucking hate Will Payton.
He's way down here.
Yeah, I mean, like, he super sucks, but man, that's mean. Okay, I think he goes between, if we're going to put him down there, I think we put him below the Eradicator, below Cyborg Superman, below Clue Master. I think he goes just above Normal.
I'd say put him above Ten-Eyed Man, because Ten-Eyed Man's a terrible idea.
Ten-Eyed Man's terrible, but Ten-Eyed Man has been in good stories.
But he's an awful, awful idea for a character.
Okay, that's true. Superboy Prime's actually a pretty good idea. Like, the original Superboy Prime is a pretty good idea. So 299 on the list. One less than you'll find at the Hot Gates with Leonidas. That's right. Superboy Prime.
Thank you, Tom, for sending in that list. If you would like to send us a panel president list, you can do so at our email address, which is warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That email address is also where you can send every story ever lists. If you have listener questions, you can send them there. Or if you want to sponsor the show, you can let us know there or just drop us a line about something else. You can also send us listener questions on our Tumblr, which is warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. Check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can download the show, stream the show, leave comments, and read show notes. Also, check us out on Apple Podcasts. If you like the show, leave us a review there or wherever you download podcasts, because that would help us. Now we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us online. For me, all you have to do is go to mattdwilson.net, and you will find links to all of my stuff, my comics, my other podcasts, my books. Chris, where can people find your stuff?
People can find my stuff by just going to the-isb.com. You'll find links there to all the comics that I write, columns that I write here and there online, all sorts of good stuff. Also, head to your local comic book store. Sword Quest is out in paperback this week. And we're super proud of what we were able to do with that book. So if you have not read it, the cover price is $20. So pick it up at your local comic book store or grab it from Amazon or Comixology if you cannot get it there. Also, it was just announced the day we are recording this, Chad and I are coming back to Darkhawk for another 4-issue miniseries. So if you enjoyed what we did with Darkhawk number 51, we're going to be tied into the Infinity Countdown event. Doing some cool Darkhawk stuff. If you've been reading Guardians of the Galaxy and you've seen some stuff going on with the Raptors, we're going to be dealing with a lot of that, and it should be pretty fun. So, hot news.
Yeah, congratulations on that new miniseries. Before we wrap up, we have a cause suggestion from listener David LaRosse. He wants you all to know about No One Left Behind, which is at nooneleft.org. It's a nonprofit that works to resettle foreign citizens who've worked with the U.S. military abroad as translators or in similar roles. Regardless of your feelings about the wars they're part of, the military promises special immigration status in return for their help. And if the government doesn't follow through or they can't make the trip for financial, health, or family reasons, it can go very badly for them. No One Left Behind helps with the costs of an intercontinental move, reunites families, has volunteers to help with things like banking and job hunting in a new country, and provides legal counsel for immigration actions. They take monetary donations, volunteers, and he recently discovered furniture and other home goods. His living room set is now furnishing a starter apartment for one of their families.
That's awesome.
David says he's not involved with them beyond donating a few times, but he did have a direct encounter that's left him a believer in the work they do. He was in a local diner in the DC suburbs with his family and happened to be in the room when No One Left Behind's founder surprised a former Afghan translator with his entire extended family, three generations, ages 6 to 60 plus, fresh off a plane from Dulles Airport. The translator had to leave them behind when he moved here and had no idea that they'd been cleared to immigrate. Their joy at seeing each other again was amazing to watch. So that's the kind of work that No One Left Behind is doing. That is great work for people who deserve help. So go to noneleft.org and help them out.
That is a genuinely heartwarming story and a genuinely good cause too. Is a real tragedy when people help out and are unable to get the reward that was promised to them for that. So anything that can make that a little easier on them, I think, is a cause well worth supporting.
And with that, we're wrapping up War Rocket Ajax number 389.
That's right, Matt. I think it was a good one. We had some good talk about some rough characters.
Yep. Despite that, though, the certification is in. We're HQC for the 389th time. And if you count like all our Every Story Ever specials and all that stuff, probably like, you know, going on 500.
I mean, it's probably the 389th time. I'm not going to lie. Look, we, you know, it's always HQC. We have a lot of fun with that bit, but let's be real here. It's probably been about 20 bad ones, but not this one. This one was great. Thanks once again to Kelly Thompson. Thank you, Matt. And thank you, the listener. Have a great week, everybody.
We love you.
Yeah! Flash.